Hello, 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 and welcome back, geeks, freaks, and tomb dwellers, to another episode of Tombs of Horror. As always, I'm your host, Dustin. And yes, I know, I've been kind of erratic with my episode release schedule lately, but at least I'm trying to put episodes out at least one a week. I've been kind of busy with physical therapy lately, so that's been taking up a good amount of my time, and why I haven't been releasing episodes on Thursdays. But as I get back into the groove of things, I should be back to my regular release schedule. But anyway, keeping up with the theme from last week, or whenever the last time I released a fucking episode was, I believe it was last week, the Critters episode, I decided to do an episode on alien invasion horror movies. So that's what you're in store for today's episode. So let's get right into it with 2006's Slither.
Throughout the years, these classic horror films had one thing in common. Universal Pictures comes a film so shocking.
We've got a real problem here.
So disgusting.
Don't let him in your mouth!
It will change the face of horror.
They're doing things to people, turning them into some kind of monsters.
How's everybody's evening? Good?
A meteorite containing a malevolent, sentient extraterrestrial parasite lands on Earth and enters the town of Weasley, South Carolina, where it infects wealthy resident Grant Grant, who is married to his wife Starla, taking over his body and absorbing his mind. With the alien in control of his body, Grant begins to transform into a grotesque, tentacled monstrosity. He also abducts and infects a local woman named Brenda to serve as a breeder for his alien larva. However, the parasite ends up gaining its host's love for Starla and eventually ends up caring about her to the point he tries to hide the truth from her. Starla becomes suspicious over the changes in his appearance and his behavior, leading to Grant attacking her. And when the police arrive to rescue Starla, Grant flees. During their search for Grant, a posse led by Police Chief Bill Party discovers Brenda, whose body has become inhumanly bloated from the larva impregnated inside her. The slug-like larva bursts from her body, which infests everyone in town except Starla, Bill, Mayor Jack McReady, and teenager Kylie Strutmeyer. Kylie tells the others the truth about what happened to Grant because she bonded briefly with one of the slugs, and the parasite's true form is a needle, which then takes over a life form to use as a host and then turns those infected into breeders to bring out Grant's larva to take over other life forms. Then, those infected by the larva become part of a hive mind controlled by the parasite who intends to consume all life forms until only his consciousness remains. The survivors deduce that killing Grant, the parasite's host, will eliminate the rest of the aliens before they are attacked by the infected townspeople. Bill and Kylie manage to escape, but Starla and Jack get captured. Armed with a grenade to kill the monster, Bill and Kylie head to Grant's home, where the infected are being absorbed by the increasingly mutated Grant. Jack and the others are turned into breeders from our larva, while Grant keeps Starla uninfected in the hope of reclaiming her love. After euthanizing Jack at his own request, Bill tries to use a grenade, only for it to fall into a pool where Grant knocks it away. Grant subdues Kylie with a couch and attempts to infect Bill with his tentacles, but Bill manages to attach one of the tentacles to a propane tank. Filled with flammable gas, Grant is shot by Starla and explodes, killing the rest of the aliens in the process. With everyone else in Weasley dead, the three survivors head off to seek help. However, in a post-credit scene, a cat approaches Grant remains and becomes infected by the alien parasite as a movie comes to a complete close. Taking inspiration from the B-movie classic Night of the Creeps, which I will get into later in this episode, this is kind of like a loving throwback to the 50s alien invasion movies of the 1950s, like I just said. And there are some scenes in this where I'm pretty sure, like, some mistakes were purposely left in, once again, to pay homage to those movies. Like, in some of the scenes, you can quite clearly see the slugs, the alien parasite slugs, being dragged across by wires. And if you watch some of the old 50s alien invasion movies, you can quite clearly see the same thing. So I think it was purposely done, once again, to pay homage to those. But this does have a good amount of black comedy in it. Actually, a lot of black comedy in it. And it is pretty, or fairly gory, I'd say. And it has a good cast that does the best they can with a pretty stupid premise and story and stupid characters who go throughout most of the movie doing stupid fucking things. But it's thoroughly entertaining. This was made for $15 million, but was considered a flop since it only earned $12.8 million at the box office, but it has since become a cult classic. IMDb gave it a 6.5 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a surprising 87%. Letterboxd a 3.3 out of 5. And I give it a 4 out of 5. And that brings us to the next film, 1982's Extro.
You're back. Back from where?
I'm not sure.
Has returned.
Wanted to make a bloody horror film, you know, and horrify everyone and be disgusting and shock people.
As far as I was concerned, the more extreme we went, the better.
It's probably one of those memorable scenes in cinema.
It sounds strange as I enjoyed it, but it was interesting, a very interesting part.
The world of Extra is a world of questions.
One night, while Sam Phillips and his son Tony are playing outside their farm, Sam is abducted by a bright light. 3 years later, the light returns and plants a seed. A half-human, half-alien creature develops from the seed and is hit by a car. The couple in the car are killed soon after by the creature. It then goes to a cottage nearby where it attacks and impregnates the young woman living there before dissolving. When she awakens later, her belly rapidly grows to a gargantuan size until she gives birth to a fully formed Sam, which kills her. Sam washes himself, steals the driver's clothes, and leaves in the car. Sam then seeks out Tony, who lives in an apartment building in London with his mother Rachel, her new Canadian-American boyfriend Joe Daniels, and French nanny Annalise Mercier. Tony has recurring nightmares where he wakes up soaked in another person's blood. Later on, Sam picks Tony up from school and is found by Rachel. Despite Joe's concern, Sam goes to live with the family, claiming that he can't remember anything. After Tony sees Sam eating the eggs of his pet snake, Sam comforts him and drinks his blood. Tony soon discovers he has paranormal powers, which he uses to send a human-sized toy soldier to slaughter a neighbor who killed his snake and to bring a toy clown to life. Sam and Rachel then visit the farm where they used to live, leaving Tony in Annalise's care. During a game of hide-and-seek with Tony, Annalise is knocked out by the clown and used as a womb for the alien eggs. Tony then sends a toy tank to attack her boyfriend Michael, who is killed by a panther as he tries to flee. Meanwhile, while Sam and Rachel make love at the farm, his skin starts to bleed and decompose. Joe takes Tony to the farm, where Sam takes his son up a hill towards the alien light, and Sam, now taking the form of an alien, uses his scream to kill Joe. Sam and Tony then enter the light and return to the alien world, leaving Rachel behind. Arriving back at home the next day, Rachel finds the apartment full of eggs, and as she picks up an egg, Rachel is killed by a newborn creature, and the movie ends. However, this movie does have an alternate ending, which intended the film to end with Rachel coming home to find the apartment filled with clones of Tony, having apparently come from the alien eggs which the real Tony had left in the refrigerator. The clones then greet Rachel and rub her growing belly as Rachel is now pregnant with Sam's second child, and Rachel then smiles as the movie ends. And this is, can be found on special editions of Blu-rays of the movie. While this is a nice little combination of sci-fi and horror, it is quite strange and bizarre. And that kind of detracts from enjoyment, or full enjoyment, of the movie. It's not a bad movie, it's just really fucking weird. And there are some quite gory scenes that are rather intense. They're good, but they're fucking intense. And the storyline is quite interesting, but the weirdness kind of destroys the storyline, if you get my meaning. But it's definitely worth a watch. It was also followed by two sequels. The second one, Extra, The Second Encounter, it's okay, but the third film and the final one, avoid at all costs. It has absolutely nothing to do with any of the previous movies, and it's a fucking bad movie. So if you're gonna watch any of these, definitely watch the first one. The second one is alright. It's not necessary viewing, but it's just okay. But like I said, avoid the fucking third one at all costs. IMDb gave it a 5.6 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a 38%. Letterboxd a 3.2 out of 5, and I give it a 3.5 out of 5. And that leads us into 2011's Attack the Block.
Yo, check it.
More what?
Them things. Lovely fireworks.
Mommy, it's an invasion.
Of course it is.
I'm killing them straight. Let's get two lot, blood.
They're quite sweet, really, aren't they?
That looks triple the size. Right now, I feel like going home, locking my door, and playing FIFA. What was this?
I think I'm probably aiming.
Would invade some council estate in South London.
One is looking for a fight.
What is that?
Sorry about the driving. I'm getting letters for Christmas.
Whoa! Got no credit.
Got one text left. This is too much madness to explain in one text.
You have to call the police.
You'd be better off calling the Ghostbusters, love.
No.
What's wrong with you, man?
You got two.
Jesus, he looks about six.
A 9 and a half.
You need to get off the streets. Back in the block.
While walking back to her car on Guy Fawkes night, trainee nurse Samantha Adams is mugged by a gang of teenage hoodlums, which consists of Pest, Dennis, Jerome, Biggs, and leader Moses. When a meteorite falls from the sky into a nearby car, Samantha escapes, and as Moses searches the wreck of the car for valuables, his face is scratched by a small alien creature. The creature then runs away, but the gang chase and kill it. Hoping to gain fame and fortune, they take the dead animal to their acquaintance, cannabis dealer Ron, and his boss, Hi-Hats, a local gang leader. More objects begin to fall from the sky, and eager to fight the creatures, the gang arm themselves and go to the nearest crash site. However, they find these aliens are much larger and more threatening. Fleeing the aliens, the gang are intercepted by two policemen accompanying Samantha, and Moses is arrested. The aliens then follow Moses and maul the unarmed officers to death, leaving Samantha and Moses trapped inside a van. Dennis reaches the vehicle first and drives away, only to crash into Hi-Hats' car. Samantha then runs away, while the rest of Moses' gang catch up and confront Hi-Hats and his henchmen. The gang then try to flee to Wyndham Tower, a tower block, but are attacked by the aliens. Biggs is forced to hide and Pest is bitten in the leg, and they find that Samantha lives in their building and persuade her to treat Pest's leg. An alien then bursts in and Moses kills it with the samurai sword. Realizing that the group was not lying about the creatures being extraterrestrials, Samantha then joins them. The gang then moves upstairs to the flat owned by Tia, Dimples, Deanna, and Gloria, believing that their security gate will keep them safe. The aliens instead attack from outside, smashing through the windows and decapitating Dennis. The girls then believe them to be the focus of the creatures and kick them out of the flat. Hi-Hats and two more henchmen attack the gang, but an alien arrives and chases Hi-Hats and the henchmen into a lift, only Hi-Hats makes it out alive. Making their way upstairs to Ron's weed room, the gang runs into more aliens, but using fireworks as a distraction, they manage to fight their way through. Jerome then becomes disoriented in the smoke and is killed by an alien. The rest enter Ron's flat and find Hi-Hats is waiting for them there, who prepares to shoot Moses, but he is then suddenly attacked and killed by aliens who break in through a window. The group then flee and are joined by Bruce, one of Ron's customers, and a zoology student. Moses, Pest, and Samantha retreat into the weed room while Ron hides elsewhere in the flat. In the weed room, Bruce notices a luminescent stain on Moses' jacket under the ultraviolet light and theorizes that the aliens are like spores drifting through space on solar winds until they chance on a habitable planet. After landing in an area with enough food, the female lets off a strong pheromone to attract the male creatures so that they can mate and continue on their species. And he theorizes that Moses may well be carrying the female scent, which may be attracting males to the block. Moses then persuades Pest to return Samantha's stolen ring, and together they form a plan. As Samantha has not been stained with the alien pheromone, she can go to Moses' flat and turn on the gas oven. Samantha then successfully bypasses the aliens and turns on the gas in the flat. She leaves the tower block and Moses, with the corpse of the small alien strapped to his back, runs to the gas-filled apartment with all the aliens following him. He then throws the corpse into the apartment and with a firework ignites the room and leaps out the window. The resulting explosion kills all the aliens and leaves the high-rise flat in flames. In the aftermath, Moses, Pest, Bruce, and Ron are arrested and held responsible for the deaths all around the block. The police then asked Samantha to identify Moses and his friends as those who killed everyone, including the two police officers who had arrested Moses earlier. Instead, Samantha says the boys are her neighbors, and they protected her. In the back of the police van, Moses and Pest hear the residents of the block cheering for Moses, and they both smile, and the movie ends. Produced by the people that brought us Shaun of the Dead, this is very much like Shaun of the Dead, just replacing aliens with zombies. Not to say that that makes this a bad movie. It's actually very good, with decent special effects and good acting, even though sometimes the British accents make it a little hard to understand what the actors are saying. But like I said, it's a very good movie. And much like Shaun of the Dead, there's a lot going on in scenes that you probably won't notice until you rewatch it. Which this is definitely worth multiple rewatches. It's also kind of interesting to see Nick Frost in a movie without Simon Pegg, who is pretty much his acting partner in every movie he's been in, except for this. But it's nice to kind of see him try to branch off on his own. IMDb gave it a 6.7 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a surprising 90%. Letterboxd a 3 out of 5. And I give it a 4.5 out of 5. Next up we have 1986's Night of the Creeps.
The night of the full moon is finally here. For Chris, Cindy, and JC, it's going to be the best night of their lives. But tonight is also the night of the creeps. From a world unknown comes a nightmare unimagined. First, they are under you, around you, on you, then inside you.
They get into your mouth and you walk around while they incubate, even if you're dead.
They are a new
exploding heads, creepy crawlies.
We could have a little problem.
The creeps are taking over.
I got good news and bad news, girls.
What?
The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
You have never had a night like this. Night of the creeps. If you scream, you're dead.
Opening in 1959, we are taken on board a spacecraft where two aliens race to keep an experiment from being released by a third member of the crew. The seemingly possessed third alien shoots a canister into space, where it crashes to Earth. Nearby, a college man takes his date to a parking spot where they see the fuck when they see a falling star and investigate. It lands in the path of an escaped criminally insane mental patient, and as his date is attacked by the axe-wielding maniac, the boy finds a canister from which a small slug-like beam jumps out and into his mouth. 27 years later, in 1986, Chris Romero pines over a lost love, supported by his disabled friend, JC. During Pledge Week at Corman University, Chris spots a girl, Cynthia Cronenberg, and falls instantly in love. To get her attention, he decides to join a fraternity, and Cynthia's boyfriend, who heads a Beta Epsilon fraternity, tasks them with stealing a cadaver from the University Medical Center and depositing it on the steps of a rival fraternity house. Chris and JC find the frozen corpse in a secret room, but when it grabs them, they flee. The thawed corpse then kills a medical student working at the lab. Detective Ray Cameron, a haunted cop, is called into the cryogenics lab break-in, where he discovers one of the bodies, the boy who discovered the alien experiment in 1959, is now missing, set free by Chris and JC. The corpse then makes its way back to the sorority house, where he picked up his date 27 years ago. There, his head splits open and releases more of the slugs. Called to the scene, Detective Cameron finds body, interpreting the condition of the head as a result of an axe wound in the face. Excuse me. Next day, the fraternity brothers confront Chris and JC, who they believe to be responsible for the previous night's incident. They are then taken in for questioning by the police, and based on a testimony of a janitor that witnessed them running out of the University Medical Center, screaming like banshees, they confess to breaking in but deny moving the corpse. That night, the dead medical student arises from his slab and runs into the janitor. Meanwhile, Cynthia attempts to convince Chris and JC that the attacks are zombie-related, but they laugh and are skeptical. When JC sees Cynthia leaning on Chris's shoulder, JC leaves the two alone and is attacked by the slugs that emerge from the possessed janitor while he's in the bathroom. After Chris walks Cynthia back to the sorority house, he runs into Detective Cameron, who has overheard their conversation. At his house, Detective Cameron explains to Chris that the escaped lunatic's 1959 victim was his ex-girlfriend, and that he secretly hunted down and killed the ex-murderer in revenge. After Detective Cameron reveals that he buried the body under what is now the sorority house, he gets a call that the same axe-wielding lunatic has killed the house mother. Arriving on scene, Detective Cameron blows off the corpse's head with the shotgun, which then releases more slugs. The next night, while everyone prepares for the formal dance, Chris finds a recorded message that JC posthumously left for him, saying that the slugs have incubated in his brain, but he has discovered that they are susceptible to heat. He confesses his love to Chris and wishes him luck with Cynthia, and Chris then recruits Detective Cameron, who was in the midst of a suicide attempt, and they retrieve a flamethrower from the police armory. They arrive at the sorority house just as Cynthia breaks up with Brad, who has become possessed. After killing him, the Beta Fraternity brothers show up, despite having been killed in a bus crash. And Cynthia and Chris team up to destroy the outside zombies as Detective Cameron clears the house. After they stop the horde, Chris spots more slugs racing towards the basement, and Cynthia explains that a member of the sorority had received specimen brains for biology class. In the basement, they find an enormous pile of slugs and Detective Cameron tape across his mouth, prepping a can of gasoline. Detective Cameron begins counting down as he splashes gasoline, and Chris counts down in sync with him as he and Cynthia race out of the house. As Cameron opens up the house's gas valve, several slugs leap to attack him, and he flicks his lighter and the house goes up in a fire explosion. And then Chris and Cynthia share a kiss as they watch the house burn. Later on, Cameron's very crispy corpse walks down the road, collapses on the ground, and his head splits open, releasing two slugs who scurry into a cemetery. And as the movie ends, we see a bright light shine from up in the sky in a cemetery that the slugs had escaped from. And then we see the alien spacecraft from the beginning of the movie slowly moving across the sky, assumedly hunting down the alien slugs. While this is quite rightfully considered a B-classic, at only an hour and a half long, this movie really seems to drag on and on for some fucking reason, and I can't really understand why. I mean, it's not a bad movie. Well, it's a B-movie, so it's not a great movie, but it is entertaining. But for some reason, the first half of this movie really drags on and on, pretty much up until the bus crash that kills the fraternity brothers. And I don't really know why, but like I said, it just seems to really drag on. But it's a nice mix of alien slash zombie invasion. And there, if you notice, this, some of the names are some of the characters' last names are homages to famous horror directors. Like the university they go to is Corman, University, which is quite obviously an homage to Roger Corman and stuff like that. This only earned $591,366 at the box office, so it was considered a bomb. But as I mentioned before, it has become a cult classic. IMDb gave it a 6.8 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a 74%. Letterboxd a 4 out of 5. And I give it a 3.5 out of 5 just because, like I said, the first half really seems to drag on and on. And that leads us into the next film, 1987's Bad Taste. The Astro Investigation and Defense Service, also known as AIDS, sends their agents Derek, Frank, Ozzie, and Barry to investigate the disappearance of the entire population of the town of Kayohoro. They find the town has been overrun by man-eating space aliens disguised as humans in blue shirts. Barry kills one of the aliens and is attacked by the others, and after Derek notifies Frank and Ozzie, he begins torturing Robert, an alien they caught earlier. Robert's screaming attracts a number of aliens in the area, and Derek kills the would-be rescuers, but he's attacked by Robert and falls off a cliff ledge, presumably to his death. Meanwhile, a charity collector named Giles is passing through Kaihoro. He is attacked by Robert, but escapes in his car. He then stops at a nearby house for help, and another alien answers the door and captures Giles. He later wakes up in a tub of water filled with vegetables and is told he is about to be cooked and eaten. Derek also wakes up to find that he has landed in a seagull's nest and also finds that his brain is leaking out the back of his head, so he stuffs it back in and uses a hat to hold it in place. That night, Frank, Ozzie, and Barry infiltrate the alien's house and find a room filled with bloody cardboard boxes. They kill a nearby alien and Frank wears its shirt to infiltrate an alien meeting. He finds out that the residents have been harvested for alien fast food and also hears of their recent hostage. Robert then vomits into a bowl which the aliens dine on, including the disguised and disgusted Frank. He escapes and tells the others of the plan and they sneak out to save Giles as the aliens sleep. At sunrise, they try to leave but are attacked by the aliens, which quickly dissolves into a gunfight. Derek emerges and his hat is shot off due to the ensuing gunfire, and he starts losing more of his brain, so he uses his belt as a headband. He then grabs a chainsaw from the boot of his car and heads for the alien house. As the boys leave with Giles, the alien leader, Lord Crumb, and his followers transform into their true form and follow. as he uses a rocket launcher to blow up Frank's car, because it has been overrun by aliens, and Frank and Ozzy hunt for Lord Crumb and kill many aliens along the way. Meanwhile, Derek kills an alien with his chainsaw and replaces the missing parts of his brain with its brain. An alien then prepares to shoot Frank and Ozzy, but is beheaded by Derek after he bursts through the wall behind it. And happy to be saved, Frank and Ozzy are still shocked to see him alive. After they escape the house, Lord Crumb shoots Ozzy in the leg, and Frank fires his rocket launcher at the leader, but it misses and almost hits Derek, finally taking out a sheep in a nearby meadow. Derek is then knocked out by Lord Crumb, and the house transforms into a giant spaceship, which blasts off into space with Derek still on board. Derek then looks out the window to see that he's leaving Earth, and Crumb is killed by Derek, who ambushes him and cuts through the alien with his chainsaw. Derek proclaims into his phone, "I'm coming to get you bastards," and then puts on the alien leader's skin, laughing maniacally as he rockets towards the alien planet. Meanwhile, back on Earth, the rest of the group drive away into the sunset in Derek's car as the movie ends. Made years before Peter Jackson, who directed this movie, was making mad Lord of the Rings and King Kong money. These are the kinds of movies that he made, along with Heavenly Creatures, Dead Alive, and this, which is, next to Dead Alive, it's probably the goriest movie he's ever made. And much in line with the movie's title, most of this movie is in pretty bad taste. The gore, the jokes, pretty much everything that's done in this movie is in bad taste, but it's entertaining. The gore is a little over the top at times, and it's definitely not something you want to let your kids see, especially young ones, really young ones. Because it's basically a splatter film, which shows how much Peter Jackson has changed in his film directing. The acting is pretty terrible and not good. That's probably the best I can say about it. But it's still a decent enough movie for as low budget as it is. And it's definitely worth at least one watch, if you can stomach it. IMDb gave this a 6.5 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes, a very surprising 71%. Letterboxd, a 3.2 out of 5. And I give it a 3.8 out of 5. Next up, we have 1992's Bad Channels.
Town of Pahuta is tuned to Superstation 66. But while dangerous Dan O'Dare is rocking the airwaves, a disc jockey from outer space is about to change the frequency to total terror. Offering a prize to any beautiful woman who's listening.
Hey, what are they doing? It's intense.
A one-way trip to another galaxy.
This sucks. It was one of those things in the
galaxy. Aliens are using my voice to aim the machinery.
Oh my God.
Turn off your radios, people. They're doing it again.
Bad Channels. In space, no one is safe from rock and roll.
When an alien DJ and his robot companion invade a radio station, they are there to capture female listeners. As they capture women, the women appear in a music video, and after the video is completed, the women are shrunk and imprisoned in clear tubes. Realizing what the aliens have planned, the radio station's original DJ warns his listeners to turn off the radio, but isn't taken seriously by anyone until more women go missing, piquing the interest of the military. Eventually, the DJ discovers that the aliens are weak to common disinfectant, using it to defeat them and rescue the women. All the women, with the exception of a teenager named Bunny, are returned to their normal size. And that, which leads into the sort of sequel, Dollman vs. Demonic Toys, which I talked about way back in, I think it was like the third episode of season one. And it's a sort of sequel because it features characters, it's a kind of a crossover between this movie, Demonic Toys, and Dollman. Made by my personal favorite low budget company, Full Moon Productions, this is a pretty goofy and cartoonish piece of lightly entertaining trash. It's definitely not one of the best movies in Full Moon's back catalog. And even though this is going pretty far by saying it because they have produced a lot of silly movies, this is probably the silliest one they've ever produced. And that's surprising during the time this was made, which was the early 90s. All the creature and makeup effects are pretty tacky. But it'll probably add some appeal for some viewers that are really into low-budget trash movies like this. And the acting, though, is surprisingly pretty decent, even though some of the actors are pretty shit, to say the least. IMDb gave it a 5 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes, a 25%. Letterboxd, a 2 out of 5. And I give it a 2.5 out of 5, just because it's so stupidly cheesy. That brings us to the final film of the episode, 1987's The Hidden.
I want this car.
Jonathan Miller would never do anything to break the law.
I need the key. Thank you. Bye.
He is a very fine, very honest gentleman.
Something strange is happening to some ordinary people.
Yeah, that's Jack. Real nice man. What'd he do, rob a bank?
He's a law-abiding taxpayer minding his own business. Killed 12 people, wounded 23 more, stole 6 cars, most of them Ferraris. If anybody deserves to go that way, sure in the hell's him. I've worked homicide for 13 years now. I have never seen anything like this. Now I want to know why it takes 15 shots to take down some sold-out stripper. Why 3 law-abiding citizens all of a sudden go crazy and start killing people?
Are we talking spacemen here?
Something gets in his way, he kills it.
Finds a body, gets inside, uses it to move around.
Try for one of the tires. Do you think this is easy? Why don't you try?
A career in the police didn't really prepare you for this, did it?
The Hidden.
You think it's over now? You're wrong.
One day, Jack DeVry is a quiet citizen with no criminal past at all. Robs the Los Angeles Wells Fargo Bank, kills all the security guards inside, and leads the LAPD on a high-speed chase. The chase ends when DeVries encounters a police blockade overseen by Detective Thomas Beck, and DeVries is shot several times, smashes through the blockade, and crashes the Ferrari he is driving. DeVries is taken to a hospital, where a doctor informs Beck and his partner, Detective Cliff Willis, that DeVries is not expected to survive the night. Upon his return to LAPD headquarters, Beck and his supervisor, Lieutenant John Masterson, the FBI Special Agent Lloyd Gallagher, who informs them that Beck has been assigned to work with Gallagher to track down DeVries. When told of DeVries' condition, Gallagher rushes off to the hospital. Meanwhile, at the hospital, DeVries suddenly awakens and, disconnecting his life support equipment, approaches the comatose man in the next bed. Jonathan P. Miller, after DeVries forces Miller's mouth open, a slug-like alien emerges from DeVries' mouth and transfers itself into Miller's body. Gallagher then arrives to find DeVries dead on the floor and Miller's bed abandoned. Gallagher then tells Beck to put out an alert on Miller, but Beck refuses because Miller has no criminal record. Miller then goes to a record store where he beats the store's owner to death. He then goes to a car dealership where he kills three men and steals a red Ferrari. He then visits a strip club where the alien leaves Miller's body and takes over the body of a stripper named Brenda. Gallagher then asks police to track Brenda when he sees her picture next to Miller's body. Brenda is then propositioned by a catcaller, and she accepts and follows him to his car. They proceed to have sex in a parking lot, which then results in the poor man's death. And Brenda takes his car. Gallagher and Breck pursue her to a rooftop, where they mortally wound her in a gun battle, and as Brenda dies, Gallagher points a strangely shaped alien weapon at her. However, she leaps from the roof, and as Masterson arrives from his house to take charge of the scene, the alien transfers itself from Brenda's dying body to Masterson's dog. Frustrated by Gallagher's continuing refusal to explain the strange phenomenon of ordinary citizens turning into crazed killer, Beck arrests him and puts him in a jail cell. Beck then soon learns that Gallagher is an imposter, impersonating the real Agent Gallagher, who is dead. But when Beck confronts Gallagher with this information, Gallagher tells him that he, Gallagher, is an extraterrestrial lawman and that they are in fact pursuing an alien thrill killer who has the ability to take over human bodies. Beck, of course, dismisses the story as insane and leaves Gallagher incarcerated in a jail cell at the police station. Meanwhile, back at Masterson's house, the alien leaves the dog's body and enters Masterson. In the morning, Masterson goes to the police station and seizes a number of weapons, sparking a shootout between himself and the station's police officers as he attempts to track down Gallagher. Convinced of Gallagher's story due to Masterson's immunity to excessive bullet wounds, Beck releases him from his cell and the two confront Masterson. During the resulting shootout, Masterson confirms that Gallagher is an alien law enforcer named El Hagu, who has been pursuing the alien ever since it murdered his family and his partner on another planet. Though Beck manages to stop Masterson, Gallagher reveals that his weapon cannot kill the alien when it is inside a human body, as the weapon does not work on human skin, thus requiring him to present when it is transferring hosts. They are unable to stop the alien from abandoning Masterson's body, however, for that of Becker's partner Willis, who then escapes the station. Using Willis's credentials, the alien tries to gain access to Senator Holt, a likely presidential candidate, at the hotel where the senator is staying. Gallagher and Beck follow Willis, and a shootout ensues between Beck and Willis, during which Beck is severely wounded. As Willis, the alien corners Senator Holt and enters his body before Gallagher can stop him. Holt then calls a press conference and announces his candidacy for the presidency. Gallagher is then forced to attack Holt in the middle of the press conference, and though shot several times by the police and the senator's bodyguards, Gallagher is able to get close enough to use a flamethrower on Holt, and as the alien emerges from Holt's charred body, shocking everybody, it collapses and Gallagher kills it with his weapon. Taken to the hospital where Beck is being treated, Gallagher discovers that Beck is close to death, and witnessing the emotional suffering of Beck's wife and daughter, Gallagher transfers his life force from Gallagher to Beck as Beck dies. Excuse me. When she sees her miraculously recovered father, Beck's daughter initially hesitates when he reaches out to her, but then smiles and takes his hand, and the movie ends. A wildly underrated and underappreciated film. This is wildly violent, and even has kind of a, I guess you'd say, a touching sense of humor. It's kind of nice. It's a kind of nice mishmash of action, horror, and sci-fi action. And while the plot is pretty basic and simple, if you're really into action films, there's plenty of explosions in this to satisfy your action film needs. And it has since become a cult classic. It was also followed by a sequel, The Hidden Two, which, while it's alright, it's not anything compared to this first film, as most sequels are. IMDb gives this a 7 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 73%, Letterboxd a 3 out of 5, and I give it a 4 out of 5. And that just about wraps it up for me for this episode. I just wanted to bring up, my band, Raped by Wolves, is closing up on the first year anniversary of my first release, Raped by Wolves Fucking Sucks, which was released near the end of February. So we're coming up close to the 1 year anniversary of that, and if you guys haven't listened to it, then you should definitely check it out on Spotify. Personally, it's not my favorite album I've done. Actually, I kind of put that way at the bottom of my favorite albums that I've done. but it was popular enough to make me continue making the music that I do. It's a little different from what I do now. The first album is all electronic. Before I started branching out into different genres like I do now. But definitely if you want to hear the roots of Raped by Wolves, if you will, definitely check that out as we're coming upon the first year anniversary of it. And that about wraps it up. As always, you can reach me at darksyde9034. At gmail.com. I forgot my own fucking email address for a second. You can now rate a podcast on Spotify. So if you guys listen to this podcast on Spotify, I'd appreciate it if you guys would give it a rating. 5-star, 4-star, even 1-star, whatever you guys think of it, so I can kind of get a gist of how you guys feel about my podcast. Follow, subscribe, rate this podcast on whatever streaming service you listen to it on. Okay, guys, I'm starting to fucking babble and stutter and run over my own words. So that's just about gonna do it. I'm Dustin, and this has been Tombs of Horror. I'll see you guys next time.